I'm Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City.
And I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho. Welcome to America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. We're teaming up with public radio stations across the country to talk about how life has changed because of the pandemic.
This hour, we're going to focus on food. Farmers are dealing with surpluses they can't sell. Many processing plants are facing shutdowns as the virus sweeps through the workforce. And consumers are dealing with shortages.
And we want to know what life has been like for you. Have you had trouble finding certain items at the grocery store? I think all of us can say yes to that. Are you part of the food supply chain and you want to share your story? Well, wherever you are, you can tweet us at Amplified2020.
Our first guest today is Mike Poshton. He is a hog farmer in Walcott, Iowa. He also grows corn and soybeans, and he's president of the Iowa Pork Producers Association. Hello, Mike.
Good afternoon, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And you are a sixth generation farmer, and I think a lot of us have ideas about how farms work that might be a couple of generations out of date. So can you describe for us your hog operation?
Well, sure. As you indicated, we have hogs, corn, and soybeans on our farm. We're a farrow to finish farm, which that means that pigs are born on our farm and they stay here for their entire lives until they're big enough to go to market. And then as part of that, we take all the corn that we grow and feed it to our hogs, and we take the manure from our hogs and use that to fertilize the corn. So it works out to be a very nice sustainable system.
How often do you send hogs to market?
Every week, we're normally sending hogs to market. We have on our farm, there's about 600 pigs that are born every week. And so about that many are going to market every week too. From when a sow is bred to when the pigs are born and grow up and go to market, that whole process takes about 10 months total. So there's always new pigs coming along, growing up and heading off to market all the time, which is part of the reason that a disruption like this can create problems on farms.
Well, let's talk about some of the problems that can create. So you've always got pigs going to market. You've always got them reaching that market age. If they can't go to market when you've planned, what happens?
Yeah, well, you know, farms have been set up to raise pigs to a very specific size and weight, and that's the most optimal size for them to go to market and be processed. And so the whole system has kind of been set up so that pigs, you know, as soon as they're ready, they go to market, so they don't get any heavier than they have to be, because that's it's a worker safety issue, because you don't want the pigs to be too big, but it's also, you know, just the equipment that are at the processing plants can only handle animals that are so big. So when that process stops, normally we would, you know, be selling the older pigs and then cleaning the barns out, washing them and disinfecting them and getting them ready for the younger pigs to come in. And so when that stops, then we have to kind of scramble to sort of find enough space for these younger pigs that are moving up in size to try to accommodate them, because we certainly don't want to compromise the welfare of any of our pigs. We want to make sure they all have plenty of space, they have plenty of food and water, and so that becomes a challenge. And so farmers are having to kind of get creative and make the best possible use of the space they have available, and basically try to find a way to take good care of all these pigs and hopefully still get them to market eventually.
Well, I want to underscore just what a precision operation this is. You have timed out exactly when these pigs are supposed to go to market, and when they go to the processing plant, the line there is set up for pigs that are a specific size. So, you know, I think a lot of people are thinking, well, you know, send them in a few weeks when it's okay to send them, or, you know, hang on to them for a while. They actually can't go through the same system if you wait too long.
That's correct. It varies depending on the different facilities, but in general, you know, once a pig gets to about 350 pounds, then it just physically can't be handled anymore. And so what a lot of farmers, myself included, have done is we've changed the ingredients in the feed that we're feeding to our pigs to try to put them on a little bit of a diet and slow them down and try to get them to not grow as fast as they normally would. And so that the goal for that is to just try to keep them from getting too big, but you know, that's okay for a while, but then, you know, as we just spoke about, the problem is you've got other pigs that are still coming along behind them. So we've actually got quite a few pigs on kind of a little bit of a diet here to try to slow them all down a little bit, but you know, it's only going to work for so long, and eventually we're just going to run out of space. So, you know, I think the goal for every producer is to make sure every animal we raise gets used for food. I mean, that's the whole reason we're doing what we're doing, is to provide, you know, safe and healthy food for people. And so we're doing everything we can at this point to try to make sure that still happens.
Well, and I want to ask you before we go to one of our callers, and we do have a number of people already on the lines. We have heard talk in the news about the possibility that farmers might have to euthanize their pigs. And a lot of people are really horrified by that idea that we've raised these pigs for food, but then the food would just be thrown away. Is that something that you're facing, the possibility that you'll have to euthanize pigs because you can't send them to market?
Yeah, you know, even just talking about that just makes me feel sick to my stomach, and most producers are the same way. It's something, you know, believe me, we're going to do everything in our power to prevent that from happening, and we're going to do whatever it takes to put that off for as long as possible. But, you know, the unfortunate reality is that we kind of have to start to get a plan in place if it does come to that, because the only reason that would happen is if we could no longer guarantee the welfare of our animals, if, you know, they become too crowded and we can't care for them properly and keep our high standards that we normally have. You know, that's the only situation that would happen, because at that point, you know, it's not fair to the animals if they would have to suffer because there's not enough space available or something like that. So, you know, it's an absolute last resort that you know, we're all hoping that it doesn't come to that. But the sad reality is, you know, we already have, you know, possibly over a million pigs that are backed up on farms right now that should have gone to market over the last 3 to 4 weeks. So just the scale of this disruption is what's creating the problems. You know, farmers are doing whatever they can. They're selling pigs on Facebook. They're donating to the food banks. They're, you know, working with local hunters who want to process their own pigs. Or, you know, we're doing whatever possibly we can to make sure these pigs still get into the food supply.
Mike, stay with us. Mike Poshton is a hog farmer in Walcott, Iowa. He raises pigs. He also grows corn and soybeans.
And you're listening to America Amplified. I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio, along with my co-host Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. We want to take a caller right now, Janet from Tucson. Janet, tell us about what you're experiencing where you are living.
Hi. Thank you so much for what you do, and thanks for letting me be on the air. Tucson, I haven't seen any meat shortages yet, but I'm not worried about it because a lot of the meat that I buy, even though I'm not Muslim and I don't practice kosher eating, comes from the Mediterranean stores, which all has halal meat. So they do their own butchering. And, of course, there's not going to be any pork, but they have beef, they have lamb, they have chicken, they have goat. And it's all really, really good quality meat.
That's a really interesting
Mediterranean poppy. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, Janet, that's a really good point that you bring up, though, is where you're able to find that meat. So appreciate you calling in and giving us your perspective on that. Mike, this is Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio. So I'm curious about that. As Janet just mentioned, I mean, she's finding basically small, you know, local butchers. But how does that play into, you know, bigger productions?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and that's certainly an outlet that's being utilized. At least in Iowa and the surrounding states, most of the small local butcher shops are already booked out through the end of this year and into next year because, that system has already been overwhelmed by farmers trying to get pigs into the food supply. So it certainly is a viable option, and it's being utilized to the fullest extent. I'm even aware of some pigs from Iowa that have been shipped all the way over to New York State to be processed and distributed to the food banks out there. So, you know, we're looking under every rock for every possible way to get pigs processed. It all comes back to what I mentioned earlier about just the scale of the disruption. It's just so right. many pigs that, you know, it's just not something that's able to be absorbed by these other channels of processing.
Well, and Mike, let's look into the future because, of course, we'll talk more about meat processing a little bit later on, and so many meat processing workers have been just affected in really terrible ways by this virus, and a lot of plants have been closed. Maybe they're opening back up, but they have less production potential because they are putting in plans for safety. In 20 seconds, when you look to the future, what do you see?
Well, it's certainly a possibility that the amount of pigs we raise is going to have to decrease if there's not going to be enough processing capacity for what's being raised. So that, you know, that's a very real possibility for the future. Could also be that we see a resurgence in local smaller processors as well. So there's, you know, lots of different things could change when all this is said and done.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for being here today. Mike Poshton is a hog farmer in Walcott, Iowa. He's also president of the Iowa Pork Producers Association. We'd love to hear from you this hour. Tweet us at Amplified2020. We will be right back. This is America Amplified.
Welcome back. I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho.
And I'm Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. This is America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. And we're talking this hour about how our food supply has been affected by the pandemic, from producers to your dinner plate and every step along the way.
And wherever you are, we want to hear from you. If you're involved in food production, processing, maybe transportation, even sales, how has this pandemic changed your work? We are all shopping a little bit differently these days. But as a consumer, what worries you the most about the challenges that are facing our food system? Tweet us at Amplified2020.
First, we're going to hear from two fourth-generation seed farmers in Healy. It's a small western Kansas town of about 1,700 people, about how the pandemic is affecting their livelihood.
My name is Vance Emke.
My name is Louise Emke.
We farm out here in Lane County in the high plains of western Kansas. The Emkes homesteaded out here in 1885.
We farm dry land, certified seed wheat, rye, triticale, grain sorghum. And we got our corn crop up, and it's coming up great.
Coming up and looking good.
Farmers have always been dealt with a lot of uncertainty. Some people say out here, we don't need to go to casinos because farmers are the biggest gamblers of all. But we got it dealt to us in spades this go round with its COVID-19 virus.
One of the nice things about western Kansas, we live in a sparsely populated area. Out here, our population density is 2.3 people per square mile. Cattle outnumber people 50 to 1. In most of these counties out here, we have no positive cases.
as time goes on here, we have concerns about the supply chains breaking down. You know, we're coming out of the winter and you know, in terms of crop production, not much going on. But now we are going to need fuel, we need fertilizer, we need herbicides.
Labor is a huge issue. We hire a lot of work done. A lot of custom harvesters, for instance, rely on foreign workers, and a lot of those H-2A workers never made it here to the United States.
In farming, it is just critical that you get jobs done on time. And then there's this other burning issue that is really bigger than the virus, is we got a drought going on. I mean, we need rain. If we could buy a rain, we gladly would.
I guess what you're saying, Louise, is you're just out of luck, right?
Well, or up a creek without a paddle. At this point, you know, we need a plan B as well as a plan C for most things that we took for granted back in the good old days.
That audio diary came to us from Kansas News Service reporter Corinne Boyer. You can call us and join our conversation here on America Amplified. What has life been like for you? Are you having trouble finding certain items in the grocery store? Are you part of this food supply chain and would like to tell us about your story, how your work has changed? Tweet us at Amplified2020.
And, you know, Charity, you're in Iowa. I'm in Idaho. They actually are two different states, just in case people are wondering.
Yes.
if you're listening from other areas.
And totally different from Ohio.
Yeah, absolutely. Idaho's in the West. Iowa is in the Midwest. But with that being said, I think we've both noticed, just as consumers, some differences in our shopping habits. And you may have noticed there was a picture actually that went viral here in Idaho. And a lot of people were tweeting us here at our station saying, is that a real picture? Because it was basically a huge potato truck and people were grabbing potatoes and all of this. And it is, we're noticing here almost like a dumping. And what I mean by that is, as you mentioned with the farmer in the first segment, is you can't get your product to market. So that's what was happening with potatoes here in Idaho. They've been able to find like a grassroots effort to get those potatoes to people in need. But also we have a lot of dairy production here and dairy farmers having to dump milk. I mean, what have you been seeing in Iowa?
I will tell you that one of my first shopping trips right after we shut things down and started sheltering in place, I couldn't find potatoes to save my life. So while your
next
farmers,
time call me.
Right. And way too many. We didn't have any at all. We've seen egg shortages, and yet we've seen farmers with more eggs than they know what to do with. The dots are not being connected in our food supply chain right now.
That's such a good point, because we've talked about this off the air, Charity, is that when you bring up eggs, right? Well, there are a lot of these production facilities are used to, you know, sending eggs to hotels, to schools. And it's not like you can just repackage it and put it in the grocery store.
Right, right. And milk is the same deal. You know, they send them to schools. They either send them in giant bags or in small cartons. And they're just not geared up to send them any other way. So hopefully we're getting that worked out.
You're listening to America Amplified. We would love to hear from you. This hour, we are talking about the food supply chain. You know, it can be really hard to understand how farmers can have just too much food and grocery stores having too little, as Charity and I just talked about in our own experiences. But our next guest will try to help us sort out how this system works and where we're running into trouble. Chad Hart is an associate professor of economics, crop market specialist, and extension economist. Goodness gracious, that's a hard word to say some days, at Iowa State University. Chad, welcome to the program.
It's my pleasure to be with you today.
So, Chad, we heard from farmer Mike Postigan just a few minutes ago, and he talked about how COVID-19 is affecting him as a pork producer. And we are seeing some kind of stalling out really in every part of the food supply chain. I mean, so many of us, we are buying food at the grocery store. And frankly, we don't really think about the steps along the way. So let's kind of make our way back in the links in the chain. What other frustrations are farmers experiencing right now?
Well, I think, you know, as Mr. Postigan laid out, the idea is that what we're seeing is a lot of the farm produce that is being created is delayed in getting to market and delayed in getting in processing. And really, that's the crucial step right now that's having the the problem here. We have plenty of farm production. We just don't have the processing capacity right now to convert that farm production into the food products we're used to buying at the grocery stores or the food products we're used to obtaining through restaurants and food service.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? And as Charity and I were chatting about with dairy farmers, and we're seeing that here in Idaho in particular, is that these large dairy farms are having to dump the milk. And it because I would assume it, you just can't make that switch so quickly from, you know, from having your product be, you know, given, you know, where you sell it to either a school district or you sell it to a hotel versus going and picking up a gallon of milk at the grocery store.
That's correct. Because, I mean, you know, each, if you will, level of processing is directed towards where is the end product going. And if you think back pre-COVID-19, the way in general our food system works is that, you know, here in the U.S., food consumers, we eat about half our food outside the home and then the other half in our homes. Well, given the social distancing and restrictions we placed upon ourselves to try to minimize COVID-19, we have definitely shifted that balance. And when we shifted that balance, it also shifted the way and the types of food that we purchase. You brought up dairy, for example, and milk. The idea is that a lot of, especially fluid milk consumption, was handled through either restaurants or specifically here, I want you to think of the school systems. And so I think it was Charity that said, yeah, it was either being, you know, delivered in large bags or in very small cardboard containers. Now you're trying to shift all that milk into the plastic jugs that we're used to seeing at the grocery stores. Well, you know, there just weren't stockpiles of those plastic jugs around as well. And so we were trying to shift as much production as we can to meet at-home consumption, but we just can't find the packaging, the transportation. It takes time to rebuild and reconstitute that infrastructure.
And then you're seeing, as you mentioned, I mean, since we are, so many of us are eating more of our meals at home, you're also seeing that shift in demand. And a good example of that is a change in the demand for turkey. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Certainly. You know, when you're looking at turkey, I think most people think of turkey and they think Thanksgiving and, yeah, eating at home. But as far as the turkey industry, you know, when we look across the entire year, 70% of turkey consumption happens outside the home. Again, at restaurants or school systems. And so when those things got shut down, we saw a massive, if you will, reworking of, okay, what do we do with this turkey now that cannot go through its normal outlets? And so you've been seeing the turkey industry relook at, okay, how can we package for grocery stores, for home consumption? Where are the avenues where we can start to try to increase usage at home for turkey meat, trying to replace what has been lost with the shutdown of the restaurants, with the closures at the school systems?
Chad, stay on the line, would you? We want to take a caller.
We want you to call if you've been running into shortages or if you have experiences in how your job has changed, if you're part of this food supply chain. Lisa is on the line in Virginia. Hello, Lisa. Lisa, can you hear me? All right, I'm not hearing Lisa right here. She was mentioning that she's been to four different states and can't find a package of yeast anywhere. And I know that's something that a lot of people have been hearing. And Chad, that goes right along with what you were talking about earlier with we're eating differently. There are so many people baking bread now. Suddenly yeast is in incredibly high demand. So let's go now to Sarah. She is in Maryland. Hello, Sarah.
Hi there.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I have two. I get comments that are wrapped in suggestions. I heard on NPR a day or two ago about the euthanizing of the pigs and the dumping of crops because but I was very happy to hear the farmer say no, they are getting some donated and finding other ways. So that made me happy. But with the crops, I have family all over the world, and apparently in France, outside of Paris, they also have trouble with the H2 workers. They can't get immigrants in because they're not allowed into the country to pick the grapes and other crops. So what they've done is they've hired city workers, people that want to get out to the country and, you know, are within driving distance of the fields and are out of a job right now. And they're teaching them and hiring them to pick crops. And they're social distancing them by saying, you're in row one, you're in row three, you're in row five, and then make sure there's 6 feet between, or 2 meters, I think they say, between you and the guy to the left of or right of you or whatever. So that's how they're getting their crops picked. So that, because they can't depend on these workers.
Using a very creative way to come up with a workforce when their workforce has disappeared. And Chad, that's part of the food supply chain we haven't really talked about yet. We are going to dig into these processing workers who are facing all kinds of dangers right now. But farm workers are also facing dangers, but also going to be in short supply. What are our concerns there?
Well, and that's the deal. As was mentioned earlier and as the caller brought up, the idea is that we definitely do rely upon, let's call it a fluid and mobile labor supply to help move our agricultural food system along. The restrictions due to social distancing to avoid COVID-19 are definitely restricting that labor from moving around the country and between countries. Because when you think about a lot of, especially our fruit and vegetable production, along the West Coast, it definitely relies upon immigrant labor coming across and sort of working their way, not only just here in the U.S., but you see that labor work all the way from Mexico up to Canada and then back again. And so our food system is truly a North American food system in many ways because we rely upon that international transport, if you will, of labor.
We are talking with Chad Hart. He is an associate professor of economics at Iowa State University. And here in the heartland, one of the most heartbreaking parts of this pandemic has been how the virus has swept through the workforce at meatpacking plants. And in these plants, workers stand shoulder to shoulder as they process animals. Many of these workers are immigrants and refugees from all over the world, Latin America, Africa, Asia, Eastern Europe. There is a Tyson pork processing plant in Waterloo, Iowa that employs 2,800 people. More than 1,000 have now tested positive for COVID-19. Other plants around the country have also become hotspots. And our next guest, Margarita Heredia, used to work as a meat processor. She's now a business agent with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in Marshalltown, Iowa, based in the local JBS pork processing facility. Margarita, thank you so much for being here.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So a JBS plant in Colorado did become a major hotspot for COVID-19. How are things at your plant?
Well, everything, it's a chain reaction. Since our workforce has been reduced to, I don't have the exact number, but at least half or at least 40%. So our production has been reduced as well. As far as the, you know, killing hogs and stuff like that. So, it is bad right now.
And do you have an idea how many of the employees at your plant might be sick?
We don't have the exact number as far as to how many people has been tested positive. Last time I heard was less than 200. But again, we don't have the exact number since not all the people get tested. So we don't have the exact number.
Well, and I mentioned that traditionally workers in these plants do work shoulder to shoulder. I've heard people describe that they're actually often touching each other. And I know the plants are working hard now to try to put in some protection. How difficult is that in the kind of processing plant that you work in?
So unfortunately, that's how everything has been designed and nobody was ready for this kind of, you know, virus. So I know the company is doing as best as they can. And since we have less people coming to work, so it is possible to move people around and try to separate them. It's not like 100%, but they've been trying to separate them. As best as they can.
Right. Do you feel safe at work right now?
Not 100%, because when you go to work, you don't know when if you're going to get the virus or not. So, no, not 100%.
And I also want to emphasize the fact that there are some language barriers as well among the many people who work in these plants. Does the communication challenge also make this harder?
Yes, it is a big challenge. I know the union, they have a lot of different languages, and, you know, we try to communicate as best as we can. And there's also signs everywhere in different languages.
We're going to have to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking about our food supply in the age of COVID-19.
You can join the conversation. Tweet us at Amplified 2020. You are listening to America Amplified. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back. I'm Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City.
And I'm Gemma Gaudet from Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho. This is America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. We are talking this hour about our food supply and how it's been affected by coronavirus, all the way from farmers to consumers.
And there is still time for you to join the conversation. Tweet us at Amplified 2020. Tell us how COVID-19 has affected your relationship with food, or maybe you're part of that food supply chain. How has it affected your work? Economist Chad Hart is still with us from Iowa State University. And also Margarita Heredia. She is a business agent with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union in Marshalltown, Iowa. She's based in the local JBS pork processing facility. And Margarita, just before the break, we were talking about how closely people work together and how difficult it can be for these plants to put in safety precautions for workers, how many people who work in these plants speak many different languages. So communication can also be a difficult thing. I wonder if, given that a lot of the people that you work with are refugees, have been through very difficult things before, are living in a country that may not feel very welcoming for immigrants right now, do you feel like that makes people afraid to seek treatment, to seek testing, and to ask for protection?
Definitely. A lot of people are not very informed. So it is a challenge for people to seek help. And I mean, we are there to guide them as much as we can, but sometimes it is a challenge. The language barrier, you know, it's a big challenge.
Yeah. Can you tell me about the protections that you have seen put in place for the workers in the plant where you are?
Okay. Now versus before, now there's face shields available. There's surgical mask available. There's safety glasses, anti-fog. So there is, you know, more protection than before, definitely.
Have some of the workers talked to you about their fears? What are they telling you?
A lot of times when people work on the floor, and this is new for everybody, so a lot of times they tell us their concerns. So we talk to the company about it, and usually they're, you know, pretty good at working with the people if we hear from the workers.
So you feel like the company is pretty responsive?
For the most part, yes.
Well, Margarita, thank you so much for sharing your experience, and please stay safe.
Charity, we've been talking so much about meat production and processing, but the challenges that we're talking about, as you and I both know, they go way beyond livestock. So joining us now is Madeline Beck. She is Boise State Public Radio's regional reporter with the Mountain West News Bureau, and she has been talking to numerous farmers and ranchers all over the Mountain West about how COVID-19 has changed their lives. Madeline, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
So Madeline, I know you've talked with potato farmers, you've talked with dairy farmers, you've talked with ranchers. Is the conversation the same, or are they experiencing different issues?
Yeah, it's definitely regionally different, and it's different per product. So what we heard earlier in the hour with hog farms, they are producing constantly. Something like a cattle market, which we see more of here in the Mountain West, is very different. It's more cyclical. A lot of people sell their calves in the fall. So they're going to be impacted in a very different way and at very different times. Obviously, there are still those who were planning on marketing their cattle at this point through livestock auctions like steers and things, but they've been able to hold on to them like some hog farmers might not be able to because they have the space, because a lot of them have rangeland and things like that. So it is hitting this region different, and it's hitting these dairies in like Idaho a lot different because here we have much larger operations than you're seeing in other places. Idaho dairies have actually been a little bit better well off to handle some of the dairy crisis we've seen over the last several years, just because they are so large. But that's kind of hurting them more now, because every cow that you're trying to feed and keep under your roof is costing you money now that you're not making back. And obviously, we are seeing these aid packages come out of the federal government. But those, a lot of them are now very concentrated on small operations. So what's kind of helped these larger operations for so long now might actually be hurting them given the pandemic.
So the Madeline, let's talk a little bit about farmers who deal with fruit and vegetable crops, because they're being affected as well.
Oh, of course. Yeah. And so a lot of them, it's a really challenge. Every crop is different and every operation is different. If you have a much smaller operation, some of them are actually seeing an increase in sales. If you have a very small operation that's just based in a community, some people are like, oh, well, I can't find this at my store, but I know this person. So you're actually seeing an increase in very small operations. But when you see those larger operations, yeah, you are seeing these giant mountains of potatoes in Idaho that they're giving away for free. And in some of those instances, it may seem like a lot, but it might only be 10% of their crop, and they might expect to continue it on after this. But yeah, it's really operation to operation, crop to crop. I'd looked into some of the egg shortages that were happening, and it seemed like there were actually enough eggs in the market. But again, it was that repackaging, reprocessing, so that they can go to a store instead of a restaurant or something like that.
And that does seem to be what a common theme that we're hearing, is it's really hard to make that pivot from, producing for big organizations versus, someone needing to get a dozen eggs at the grocery store. Madeline, stay on the line with us.
And Barney is on the line in Grinnell, Iowa. Hello, Barney.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
The idea of the distribution and the size of the packing plants and such. I mean, we sell some of our meat locally. There are so few lockers anymore that it's hard to get into lockers, and things have gotten incredibly busy since this happened. I mean, we have customers coming out of the wall. But the idea that we have, because of the lack of antitrust legislation, our packing plants keep getting bigger and bigger. We need more small, regional-sized and smaller size packing plants, distribution, our local grocery store. They couldn't get yeast a year ago. Their distributors told them to forget it. They're not going to get any yeast. This is a reasonable size grocery store, but because they're small compared to the big chains, the other stores.
Barney, that brings up
distribution is
right. That brings up such an important point. And economist Chad Hart, can you respond to that quickly? Because we've talked about a lot about the local foods movement over the last decade or so. And one of the things is that the infrastructure that used to be available to distribute local food to local consumers is just not there. And, Barney's saying he wants to go back to smaller operations. But tell me about that infrastructure, because it's just not available, is it? At least right now.
It's not available, and it's because, if you want to think of it, our food system continues to evolve. And one of the things that has driven it over the past, especially 50, 60 years, is that in food service, there are economies of scale, which typically means the bigger you are, the more efficient you can be, the lower cost you can have, and the more competitive you are. And so that's why we have seen things move from what used to be small and local towards larger national and international corps, because of that, cost effectiveness of that delivery. In order to maintain that local structure, we end up having to pay a little more. And that's what we are seeing, as we look at the local food movement, for example, is that willingness of some consumers in certain areas to be willing to pay that additional price in order to maintain that local delivery.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see how this develops in the future as the pandemic dissipates. You can join our conversation. Tweet us at Amplified2020.
And you are listening to America Amplified. I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio, along with my co-host Charity Nebbe from Iowa Public Radio. We want to take a call from Fred from Rochester, New York. Fred, this is really interesting. We have had quite a few people call about being vegans and vegetarians, and I'm really curious to hear your take on this food processing and production issues that we are running into right now.
Well, thank you. Eating animal flesh is not an essential part of our diet. We can live very well without it. As a matter of fact, it's linked to a lot of health concerns. High blood pressure, diabetes has been slowed and even reversed in some cases with people going to a plant-based diet. And it's not environmentally friendly to grow animals for food. It's one of the biggest polluters of our environment, more than planes, trains, and automobiles.
So, Fred, from multiple
directions, it's not a good process.
So, Fred, have you run into any shortages, though, even eating a more vegetarian diet when you've gone into the grocery store?
It's fairly easy to do, and there are organic growers in Rochester area that are doing a lot online. You can go online, you can order a box of vegetables, you go and, you pay for it ahead of time, you go there, your name's on the box, you pick it up and you go.
Chad, let's bring you back into the conversation. Chad's an economist at Iowa State University. I mean, Chad, Fred does bring up a good point, right? There are people that do not eat animal products. However, with that being said, there is a large population that does. So how do we balance the two, especially right now, right? I mean, because I would think that, as we mentioned, we're seeing shortages in every facet of the food chain.
We are, and that's the deal. I think as we're looking at sort of this resorting of the food chain we're going through right now, it is figuring out how to address people's wants and needs within the food system while at the same time maintaining flow for everybody out there as far as what they're looking for. I've described what we're doing right now as a massive replumbing of the food system, in that we're not only changing what we eat, how we eat it, but sort of how we package it, deliver it, and bring it to folks. And so, as the caller mentioned, the idea of that, for some things, we're able to source those locally from our local farmers and ranchers in the area. For other products, we're having to rely upon that international food chain to deliver it. It's not, here in Iowa, I'm not going to find a banana producer. So I need to figure out, okay, what are the ways that we can get bananas through the food system to deliver it to those areas that can't produce the products that they're looking for?
Well, and that's part of it, right? Is that there's so much more than just walking into a grocery store and picking up that banana. It takes a lot more to get it into your hand.
It definitely does. And, when you think about it, it's the steps along the way of not only producing the initial product, but the processing, the packaging, the delivery of that product throughout, our grocery stores and our food system here within the United States.
Chad, thanks so much for your perspective.
We've been also
Thank
getting
you.
several tweets this hour. You can tweet us also at Amplified2020. From Patty Woodbury of Arizona, this should be making us take a hard look at our food supply and how we support those who grow and process our food. Industrial farming of animals or crops is simply not sustainable and shows little respect for the animals slaughtered, the people who process them or process crops. And let's go next to the phones. Eileen is on the line in Orlando, Florida. Hello, Eileen.
Hi. I'd like to echo that last tweet. I feel really strongly about it. And in Orlando, I'm able to find all of my produce, my milk, my meats at local farms that do what one of the men that called in, I think it was Barney, talked about. They do their own local processing of the animals, and I know how they're fed, and I know the farmers personally. Of course, it wouldn't work for large schools and restaurants, but I feel that it is a way a consumer can go straight to the farmer. I do pay more. You did bring that up. I pay $8 for a half a gallon of fresh raw cow's milk. I pay $6 for ground beef. That's probably about average, but I do pay more. I pay $6 for a dozen eggs, but I feel this is a way to support the people who transport and respect people in processing, that they don't have to do an animal within 1 minute.
Right.
Usually is how fast they have to be processed in
Eileen,
large factory farming.
Thank you so much for sharing your perspective. We are seeing a lot of people responding this way, saying, hey, you know, maybe we are overly dependent on these very inexpensive products that we rely on. We've seen people calling for a boycott of meat from some of these processing plants where workers have been sickened. Chad, our food system is set up in a very specific way to provide us with inexpensive options. How do you see things changing, perhaps, because of this moment in time?
Well, it is set up to provide inexpensive options, but it's also set up to provide safe options as well. But it is also flexible. Like I say, it's always evolving. As Eileen mentioned there, the idea is that we do have consumers that recognize, okay, if they're looking for certain attributes in their food, they want to know where it came from, they want to know that it's locally raised. If you're willing to pay that little extra in order to incentivize that production, the food system adjusts to provide that for you. We do see the growth in local foods movements, in organic production. And again, it's trying to evolve the entire system. So we'll always have what I'll call conventional food production out there, but we'll also see more growth in these specialized food markets in areas where people are willing to invest in their food options.
Well, it will be interesting to see how this develops. Clearly, this is a moment when a lot of people are thinking about something that we usually take for granted in this country. Chad Hart, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Chad Hart is Associate Professor of Economics. He's also a crop market specialist and extension economist at Iowa State University. Also with us this hour, Madeline Beck, Boise State Public Radio's regional reporter with Mountain West News Bureau. And that's all the time we have for this hour. Thank you so much for joining us for America Amplified, Life, Community, and COVID-19. You can listen back to this episode at americaamplified.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's show was produced by Caitlin Harrop in Iowa and Frankie Barnhill in Idaho. Special thanks to WABE in Atlanta and KCUR in Kansas City for working together to bring these voices from across the country to your public radio station. Thanks also to the team at America Amplified, a community engagement initiative supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Our technical director is Steven Steigman. Our coordinating producer and director is Andrea Tudhope. And our executive producer is John Haas. And the conversation doesn't end here. You can find us on Twitter at Amplified2020. From Iowa Public Radio, I'm Charity Nebbe in Iowa City.
And I'm Gemma Gaudette from Boise State Public Radio in Boise, Idaho. And this is America Amplified.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.